Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Mastering Dungeons. I'm Sean Merwin, here with my long-suffering co-host, Teos Abadia. We're in, like, almost, we're getting close to 200 episodes that you and I have officially done together.
Wow. And, yeah. And you've done, like, another 5 billion before that, so that's, like, I think my math's correct, 70 jillion.
I'm going to GaryCon. I leave tomorrow. And my wife's like, oh, I'm going to miss you. I wish I could hear your voice. I was like, just go online. There's Mastering Dungeons. There's the Eldritch Loras cast. There's probably like 10,000 hours of me talking. She's like, really? I'm like, yeah.
Nothing's better than listening to your husband on a podcast. I mean, just fall asleep to that. That's a win.
Exactly.
That's why we podcast, folks. A lot of people listening don't know that it's really for our loved ones.
Exactly. Because that's what they need. But
what they crave.
We know this, what you need if you're listening out here. You need your news. You need your listener misses. And you need our main topic. Today, our main topic is going to be more on world building. We're going to talk about starting villages when you're creating your world. So we will get to that shortly. But first, let's get to our listener corner where we start with Tancred via Blue Sky. Tancred says, listening to Mastering Dungeons and had a thought about exhaustion. Isn't it already baked into hit points? Hit points are not supposed to be just physical. They are an abstraction that includes exhaustion and luck. And that is a very, very good point. So yes, but no. The reason exhaustion in D&D is its own thing is because while it does, we have heard designers say over and over again, it's not just your physical health. Hit points mean a lot of things. But then they do have to create a separate exhaustion track if you want that to be a part of your game. Well, why is that? Because think about how you get hit points back, right? When you try to get hit points back, you don't go to a spell called Cure Luck or De-Exhausting Word, right? It's Cure Wounds and Healing Word. So on the front end, the designers have told us, yeah, it's a lot of different things. It could be all of these different things. But on the back end, when you're trying to heal them, it's a wound.
Yeah.
It's healing.
When a monster hits you, the monster doesn't deal 7 points of, boy, that was exhausting to you.
Yeah.
It's a morning star to the face.
Exactly. So in that sense, that analogy, that comparison that we've heard, and that I actually like, I mm-hmm. like to think that all of those things go into hit points. But we see when we get to healing what it really means. And so then the next step in a game designer's mind is often, well, let's make separate things. If hit points mean all these things, let's make health. Let's make wounds. Let's make focus. Let's make luck. Let's make all of these other point pools or ways to separate those things out. And then we can do different things with those. And if you can make it work, it can be probably fun. I have rarely seen a game that does those different levers or those different pools work in a way that's as elegant as just one pool of points. It gets super fidgety. One part starts to break down. If you try to get them to interact with each other, it often doesn't work well. So it's a good design goal, but it's a hard design lesson to learn.
Yeah, and I think the question proves that point, right? That exhaustion is just strange enough, ill-fitting enough that it causes these sorts of questions of, wait a minute, I thought we already had this covered. Or does exhaustion really fit this particular instance when it's being applied, right? And in the game, if you look at it, right, it's a condition, right? Yeah. It's one of the conditions in the player's handbook. And so that makes it a little interesting because it's right up there with stunned and blinded, but yet totally different. It's this thing with multiple steps, and it's meant to, we're told, scorching temperatures and, you know, freezing cold and starvation. right? So it's a very different kind of condition, but somehow still buckled in there as a condition. Clearly, we're just trying to kind of make it work, right? And the concept of was trying to cover these situations where you want a little more out of what's taking place environmentally or across travel or in some sort of situation. And that was the kind of bucket used to try to solve the problem, which it doesn't quite do, which is why we keep talking about it.
Right. And hit points work well for players because even as they lose hit points, they don't lose any power. Right. And we've talked about that as a flaw of the game, where full hit points or one hit point, you're still as powerful as you ever are, where then that last hit point does everything. But for the players, that can be a good thing because some players, and I don't want to say a majority, but a large minority, if not a majority of players, want that. They want to always to be able to know what they can do, and they don't want to be stunned, and they don't want to have minuses to their checks, and they don't want that. So by introducing it, you also have to keep that in mind. If you're introducing penalties into a game, how are the players going to react to those penalties?
And games that did it. I mean, my earliest encounter with that was Shadowrun first edition, where you'd mark off damage on a track, and oh wait, you hit, four blocks or whatever it was of damage, and now you're at minuses to stuff, and you're like, oh, that's not great. I don't like this. How do
Right.
I make this go away? And then you got into things like, oh, look how realistic your injuries are. You've been shot up in all this trouble, so it'll cost you all of the money you just earned on this job to get healed. You shouldn't have taken this job. That was a mistake.
Yeah,
Okay,
yeah,
great.
yeah.
Fun.
And some games can do it well because of the mechanics of the game. Like in Fate, you can buy off damage with basically more aspects.
Right.
And so it's not necessarily a bad thing. It can be used as a bad thing, but then you can also use it to get fate points back, and therefore it becomes an okay thing. It's fits more neatly into the mechanics of the game where a player would be more interested in interacting with it.
No, it's fascinating. I think hit points really, we try to explain it all, but the reality is it's been a great system for playing a game, right? Just the simple idea of you've got X as your number. When you get to zero, you're over, and you're able to track it, and it's a nice currency for design. It all works. And we just, at times, we just say, well, I don't know about this zero to whatever your number is system. Can't I add more to it? And that's where we come up with explanations or sub rules or whatever. But the reality is, it's great as a game system. And every other RPG that's being designed has to think of, if I don't do that, what is the funky thing I'm going to do instead? And is that funkiness actually fun? And it's a heck of a challenge, right? To try to get there, to make that other system of yours really sing when hit points just is really fun for a game, right? It's why every video game adopts it, why all these different things in life now use this hit points and XPs, because those systems work so well.
It's true. Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to say about this was, how narratively it can be challenging too, when you as the game master are trying to tell a story and you want to show the challenge of, like, you rescue an NPC, they've got a broken leg, and so you have to help them get across the desert. They can't walk. But then the cleric is like, well, I just cast healing word. And then, so you try to say, well, that doesn't, right? It heals their hit points, but they still have this wound that it's going to take time to heal. Well, why? Why does it, right? And there's that disconnect when you
My
try to
favorite,
tell this cool story.
there was an example like that, some kind of story thing where the DM was explaining, like, look, it's just their leg is still messed up, or I think it was an arm or something.
Right.
And the player goes, great, I'll just cut it off and cast reincarnate, because I can just like regenerate, right? I can just
Regenerate,
grow
yeah.
it back. So if there's some fundamental problem, I'll just cut it back further. and grow it back. And they're just, the DM's just like, I don't know what to
Right, exactly.
or any creature on its dying breath, right, that wants to communicate something. Well, I'll just heal it. If it's got time to speak, I'll save it, you know.
So there's a lot of stories that are that you might want to try to tell using 5e D&D over the years, different rules that just don't quite mesh with this rule system. So yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for asking that. And the second question this week comes from Tejas Kudva via YouTube. I hope I pronounced that right, and I'm sure I didn't, but thank you for the question anyway. I'm super interested in how a 30-minute game of D&D works. I work in a middle school, and we don't really have after-school clubs the way the high school does, but I would love to make my game club be more than introducing students to short games like Love Letter, Sushi Go, and Sorrow. Maybe a good expansion to that would be how do you make a worthwhile campaign out of a smaller number of 30-minute sessions, like a max of 9 30-minute sessions per school quarter. And also, how do you make those games DM tutorials? Because ultimately, I want 12-year-olds to be able to take over the club and start their own games at home. And as an additional question, is D&D the best system to do that? Would a 30-minute session work better with Savage Worlds or Dungeon World or some other game? Teos recently ran these 30-minute games or oversaw the running of these 30-minute games. So I'm going to let him start and then I will add my
Great.
two
'Cause
cents
I
later.
mean, the first thing I think of is Peril and Pinebrook for this question. But yeah, what is a 30-minute game of D&D? And it's great because that is exactly what we DMs asked ourselves what the first time that we saw what is in the game. And some folks have been asking about this, so I've been sharing the link. I'll put the link in our show notes here, and if you look at comments to our previous YouTube, you'll see the link there as well. But the demo we ran at Emerald City Comic Con that I was talking about last episode, that 30-minute game is available online, so you can take a look at it. And it ties into the starter set from Dragons of no, what's it called?
Dormer Kyle.
Thank you. Yes. And to all the starter sets are blending in my brain. And what it really does is it says, and this is a spoiler, but it's probably okay because I think we're gonna move on to a different adventure. But for the future shows. But the idea is you're on a ship, which makes it kind of cool, because hey, you're on a ship sailing through the ocean, and a Marrow hops on board and has some interesting box text, some interesting discussions, it says, and wants payment. And this will probably devolve into combat. And that's it. And you're like, I don't even know that this will fill 30 minutes. How could it possibly? Until you realize that what the real point of this is, the true returning player or new player that doesn't really grasp 5e at all, right? So somebody maybe has only played Baldur's Gate or just heard about D&D from a friend. They don't know which die is which. They don't know what their skills are, what how to read the character sheet, any of that. And so everything you can do to shorten things, to frame things, that's helpful, necessary, and takes time. So I ran a table for a bunch of kids when a DM didn't show up. And I, you know, it's just amazing, like as much as I was watching the clock, how much time was burned on all of these little things. Explaining initiative, explaining how you could approach something, right? Just telling an individual player, like, well, what do you think? What is your character interested in? You know, who is your character, right? All these kinds of things. Those really take up time. And so a simple scene like monster demanding money and you probably fighting it. In fact, and one of the things that's interesting as DM is you're trying to give them a fairly good experience. So the characters were talking this monster out of it and were willing to kind of pay a fair amount of money. And so I took what they said and I said, well, you know, w if you can best me in one round of battle, I will reduce the payment further. And I said to some of the players, because a couple of them were interested in being DMs, I said, you know, I'm doing this so you get a taste of combat. I've given you this answer because the demo makes more sense if you get to see how combat works. And so all of that was a 30-minute experience, but it's a really simple thing, right? It's not a complete story. In fact, one of the problems with that scenario is that It's just a moment in time on a ship on your way somewhere. There's no real closure to it. It's just this one encounter. And I wish there was a little more closure. The adventures that you've written in the past, Sean, that are more like 45 minutes to an hour, and we sometimes ran them in 30 minutes, which is tight. But those that you ran at the beginning of like the AL seasons, those really gave you a story, right? An introduction, a problem to solve, and at the end you solved it. And that those are, I mean, anyone who wants to see how you can do that in a short amount of time should look at those intro adventures because they are so good at doing that, right? Treasure of a Broken Hoard and all of those. They really summarize that in a short time frame.
It's the 8 minute abs problem. Right. It's like I can do this in 8 minutes. Well, can you do it in seven? I might be able to do it in seven. Can you do it in six? At some point you can't get a full experience even in an hour, depending on what you're trying to cover. And so the question that you have to ask is, what is the experience level of the players? What's the experience level of the game master? Because what you create is going to depend on those questions. For Peril and Pinebrook, it was this game master has never seen D&D before. So everything that the game master needs to say to the players is in box text. The character sheets are super simplified. So we're not looking, okay, strength means this and dexterity. We're not going to do any of that. We're just barely going to discuss what armor class means and what hit points mean. No saving throws, right? Super, super simplified. And so many times I see people who have been asked, what should I run as a new DM and with new players? And they're giving, I think I've said this last week, maybe, right? They're giving these adventures that are hard for our experienced DM to run, much less a new DM. So you have to decide what is it that I want to show the game master or the players in this, and then just write to that. If it's introduction to the dice, then just write an introduction to the dice. If it's an introduction to combat, then as Teos said with this one very simple combat. The rest of the time will be taken up with explanation, always. Is D&D the best game for this? No, but I don't know what the best game for this would be. It's certainly not Savage Worlds. It's certainly not powered by the apocalypse games like Dungeon World. I wouldn't even call Fate that, because in any of those games where you have a character that the player needs to absorb, not just the rules, but the sort of theme and tone of the game, then you need to explain that, and you've already spent 45
30 minutes.
minutes,
Yeah, especially with
doing
kids,
that.
right? I mean, that's where
Exactly.
Shadowdark might be a good answer to that, right? Because Shadowdark tends to have a, you could look at the character sheet, right? And if the character sheet's really easy to grasp, well, that's going to cut down on your time, right? And it's D&D-ish, but it is very simple at the character sheet level. What I would worry less about the system, right? And I often say this to folks, what should I run? Whatever you're passionate about, right? But look at what the objective is. And so if the objective is a 30-minute run, then that's what must happen, right? So what will that 30 run be? And so immediately when I think of a series of 30-minute games, I think, well, it's got to be missions, right? Where it really is like come up with a thought, like you are the city's troubleshooters, and when trouble comes, the queen sends you to take care of the problem. So we're going to start at the door to the problem each time, ready to go into combat or into negotiations or whatever the problem solving will be. And it's going to be bam, one encounter, get through it, resolution done, right? And then everything else has to be abstract because it's only 30 minutes. And that's probably true regardless of set of RPG system, right?
When I was designing all of these 1 hour adventures, the understanding was the game master knew the rules and the players sort of knew their character in order to get through this. And even then, as I was designing, I was realizing all of the things that could eat up time. And the first one is you need to give the characters a concrete goal that they can just say, all right, our goal is to go here and do this right now. Because even if you give them the slightest bit of wiggle room, they're going to spend time discussing what they should do. And then by the time you get to the adventure, you're out of time. So you need to just give them the path, say, this is what you want to do. They can still role play within that, but you've handed them the path that they're going to take to get through the adventure in the required amount of time.
One of these three merchants has the stolen gem. Figure out which one. They're
For
right in
sure.
front of you.
So I wish I had a better answer to this question. As much as I hate to say it, just look at Peril in Pinebrook, see what it does, see if it fits the needs that you have for your group, your class, your club, and you can even pare it down more. I wanted to pare it down more, but we had to make sure it was still D&D. But maybe you can figure out a way to get rid of the D20 and use D6s. Maybe you can figure a way to still tell the entire story with a little more storytelling, a little less rolling, might be helpful, right? Any of those things could be useful to you or to the young game masters that are running the game.
Perfect.
All right, so yeah, thank you for those questions. Now let's get into our news. Starting with the new D&D survey, which asked, do you like us? Seriously, what do you think about us? I don't even know where I saw the survey, but I clicked on it to see what it was. And before I even started, I felt like it was over. I'm used to like the 45-minute one, so I was like, okay, here we go. And then it was gone. The survey said, well, it was less than 5 minutes, and it basically said, do you like us? It asked, how do you feel about the game? From I hate this game to I love this game. It also asked about Wizards of the Coast specifically, and do you love or hate them as a company? And would you recommend D&D or would you recommend Wizards of the Coast products? And that was the survey. So it was sort of like the, what do they call it? The 1 to 10, would you s suggest our goods, our services to a friend that all the tech companies and all these service companies use. It was sort of like that with a couple extra questions. What do you think, Teos?
I thought it was interesting that because you and I know wizards, and often they overthink things and they can be slow to act. Partly because they care a lot, right? But a lot of different departments will weigh in on things. So I'm surprised this survey even made it out the door. And I have to imagine the survey, unless it's somehow, someone really found a way to get this through expediently, this probably bounced around forever and got pared down and worked on. And I'm surprised it just even made it out the door. So just seeing it, I was like, wow, okay, someone made this happen because there's just so many ways this would have departmentally gotten sidetracked. And I wondered how long ago they started. Also, what didn't it ask, right? It didn't ask about Hasbro, but they felt the need to differentiate between Wizards and D&D, sort of like, which is a common thing that happens in discussion. And I think it's a strange delineation. I get it where it comes from, but the idea of, oh, the company is Hasbro or it's Wizards or it's D&D. It's all those things, and when it is one or the other is at a level that generally most folks can't track without going back and having conversations with staff. So I thought it was a little interesting that they decided to break it down that way, but then didn't decide to add Hasbro into the mix. And they didn't get to the why of anything, right? So like, let's say you say, I recommend the product all the time, but I hate the company. Okay, what is it about it, right? Nothing is why. Are you mad about the OGL, which would be perfectly reasonable? Did you always hate D&D because you like other games and wish other games did better? Do you think the company's moving in bad directions because of the layoffs? Or is it that you're just saying like, wow, that movie was incredible, right? Like we don't know the why of any of it. But my guess is that what they're trying to do here is say, hey, D&D, the game, D&D, the brand, Wizards, the company, is one of these consistently getting solid, yeah, let's go, and another one not, right? Then that could be interesting that they have an image problem or something like that. But there's nothing more dangerous than a company trying to fix its, image and try to be your friend. So.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I see surveys, especially really, really short surveys, my question is generally, what's the point of this? Because generally it's either you're trying to find an answer or you're trying to elicit a specific answer for a specific reason. So you're either trying to figure out what is the problem or you're trying to actually learn something, or you're trying to prove a point, and you know what the answer is going to be. So you ask the questions in such a way to be able to take to your board, look, people think blank, and we knew this, and so therefore we need this in the budget, or therefore we need that. So that's the first thing I thought. The second thing I thought was, since it was so short, I wonder, it was interesting to me that they did D&D first, or Wizards of the Coast first, I think, in the questioning, and then D&D second, if I remember right. If I got it backwards, I apologize. But it seemed to me that, if they were trying to show people are mad at Wizards, but they still like D&D, you put Wizards first, right? The old foot in the door in the face thing, where you put the thing that you want everyone to hate on first.
All right, so
They hate on it.
they did ask about D&D first. I threw it
Okay, they
into
did ask
a
about
new
D&D
browser
first.
where I didn't take it. So they
See,
did ask about
now
D&D first.
if I wanted D&D to get a better score, I would have put it second, right? You put the thing that everyone's angry about first. Because by putting D&D first, you haven't yet given people who don't like Wizards the chance to vent about Wizards yet. So D they're gonna like, I hate D&D because it's wizards, boo. And then the next question goes up and you're like, oh, Wizards, boo, boo. Oh, I shouldn't have said the bad things about D&D because I actually like play D&D 7 times a week. And I actually kind of like it. So it's funny, those sorts of things that can be thought about as you are doing surveys like this. And my first thought was, the marketing folks are trying to get a bigger budget and they just want to show the dire situation that Wizards is in
That could
terms of
be.
public relations.
It really
And
could be
so,
that. Because one of my thoughts was immediately, well, who's seeing the survey? Like it wasn't shared through all the usual means. It was shared through certain ways. So that just even makes it more likely that like those, many hundreds of people I ran through at Emerald City Comic Con, I bet almost none of them saw the survey, right? And they probably think Wizards is made of gold and D&D is nothing but deliciousness, right? I mean, and that's what often we see at conventions, right? In fact, one of the joys of DMing at like a PAX or other convention like that is that everybody's new. They just love the game. They adore everything about it. They're like any of us were on day five, right? Just like, this is great. I want more. Please connect a fire hose to my mouth, right? You go to Gen Con and you sit down at a table and everybody's like, I love this game. Let me tell you what I hate about it. Because they're so grizzled, right?
And even within the same convention, right? You go to Gen Con, you go to the Learn to
Yeah,
Play,
it's true.
and it's everything's sunshine and roses. You go to like the high level epic, this smaller campaign, and everyone, whoa. It's totally true. So it is funny. I got a chuckle out of the survey. And I hope whatever happens, it works out, and that D&D is becomes the greatest game ever, and that Wizards is able to shepherd it in that direction.
Keep giving lots of people jobs for doing amazing work.
Yes. And speaking of things that might not be as great for Wizards and Hasbro's brand, Chris Cox says that in an interview in VentureBeat, that AI is being explored for not just D&D, but magic and a bunch of other things. So this interview with Chris Cox, who is the CEO of Hasbro and used to be the president and CEO of Wizards of the Coast, covered many topics, but then when AI came up, he gave what I'm going to call the answer that any CEO of any major corporation is forced to give. Which is, hey, look, we investors, we know what AI stands for, and boy, are we going to use it. Yeah, we're in the perfect position to use AI. And then, of
Yeah.
course, there was the backlash from people who don't want AI used in their games, of which I am definitely
Yeah.
one of them.
Card carrying member.
But it was also taken out of context, as things are online, where they just put up the quote of, yes, we're going to use AI in D&D without the everything he said before that, which was, we need to use it responsibly. It's not going to be for every part of our brand, all of those things. So I wasn't outraged by it, because it was CEO speak talking to
Yeah.
investors.
Now, ideally, well, there's only so much you can ask of folks that are at the top of the company because they're dealing with top of company type things. They don't understand the details. That's just, I mean, in my areas of work, I don't understand everything every department is working on. Like, I can't, right? And so if I were asked about that, I would probably screw it up. And that's what happens with these guys. They're in charge of the whole company, but they only understand the upper layers and then whatever meetings they happen to have recently been in on. So the way the question comes across is, hey, this other company is doing this thing with AI. What are you guys doing? And so, oh yeah, we're looking at this, of course, or that's what everybody answers, right? It's like what you have to. And yes, it would be great if we lived in a world where Chris Cox could say, AI is a fool's errand. It's a ton of money to get into it. It offers very little return to its actual customers. We're customer focused, so we're saying no to this. That'd be great, But boy, you say that and you are
You are no longer
possibly,
CEO in a
you might
week.
not be, or you're in a world of hurt or, any of that. And it's going to come up on the next investor call, whereas this is just going to go around our circles, right? Now, where I do give Chris a lot of kudos, and maybe because he's been, a little further down, he was, in charge of Wizards. He probably understands a lot of the OGL conversations and so on. He does, as you said, mention several times, more times than I would have expected, this idea of being careful about respecting the artist, the close relationship that Wizards has with them, the importance of art, right? And it was interesting, and so I think, in some ways, as bad things go, this was again not that bad and not that unexpected. It was pretty balanced, all things told. And he was somewhat baited by the interviewer, not in a terrible way, but I mean, the interviewer kind of was very cleverly kind of saying things. Like they even ask, I don't know if there's a lesson to draw from all the D&D licensing controversy, but we're going into Brave New Worlds compared to what's been allowed in the past. And really, this is bringing up the OGL, and Cox sort of doesn't quite seem to understand that and just continues along the either doesn't understand it or doesn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. And so he proceeds on into sort of more AI speak, and that he's using AI in his own campaigns to, show art to his players and so on. But there was an interesting addition to this story where on Mastodon, illustrator Denman Rook shared an email he sent to Wizards as someone who does work for them. And the company actually responded by saying, hey, let's hop on a quick call. And they jumped on a call. And the Wizards folks that he spoke to thanked him for being vocal about the issue and, quote, reiterated their commitment as a company to continue supporting human creativity and not to use AI. And a similar statement came out on Twitter, is my understanding. I didn't look at that, but so it's one of those things where it goes back to that survey we just talked about, right? What is Wizards? An evil company bent on AI destruction? A good company that actually will call an individual artist up and say, hey, let's talk through this. You know, we want to let you know where we are. All of those things, right? Right. A little bit of everything is the reality, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And, you know, this hobby, the bottleneck of this hobby, it's not information. It's not a lack of material. It's game masters.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, it's a very unique situation. So Wizards of the Coast is going to always be struggling with that, trying to find a way to make people into game masters, trying to find a way to bring players to the table, despite maybe not being able to find a game master. So AI, while it's horrible at this point, is something that someone might think, we could use this. We could have AI game masters, and they could run games for people, and it would be great. And now we have all these people waiting, hoping to join a game, being able to join a game. They're also partnering with startplaying.com, I think is the name of the website, which introduces players to game masters. So that's the direction they need to be looking in, to sites and places like that, rather than trying to fix this problem with a technology that's hated by most creatives and not likely to be able to solve the problem that they're trying to solve.
Yeah, and that's the part that I'd really emphasize in all of this, that sometimes the problem you want to solve is not meant to be solved, right? Like Lego could say, you know, one of the problems is we only appeal to people who want to spend all this time putting together sets. What if we just give you one giant chunk of plastic pre-made? Yes, that would solve that problem. Also, now your audience would be bored senseless and would not want to do this, right? And that's part of the what Chris Cox misses in this, and no shock, I'm not blaming him, but you know what is missed in this is, what is the actual value to D&D? The value to D&D isn't actually saying our classic adventures are works of art.
Mm-hmm.
Our DMs learn amazing skills that they continue to refine throughout their entire lifetime. They are rare and precious because they're rare and precious. It's an awesome skill. Not everybody can be a DM. Everybody can play it to some extent, but being awesome requires this kind of work and skill gathering. And that's why it's such a rich and awesome hobby. Not, you know, the goal is to replace all that with some DM that does it for you to just play, because we have board games, we have card games, we have ways that we can do that. If you automate the DM, you're actually cheapening the heck out of D&D as a product, as a hobby, as all of that. The same way, if Lego just gave you one giant chunk of plastic, you wouldn't be interested in it, right? That's where they need to really be careful, because you try to solve this problem, but you can end up cheapening all of what you do, cheapening your classic adventures. Because if you're going to say that your AI-generated adventure is as good as anything, well, then what was the point of all that? Why are we celebrating 50 years of D&D, right? If you're going to say that now you don't need a DM, why do you have a Dungeon Master's Guide? Why do you have all these supplements, all these how-tos, all the, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you need to pull back to really see what's the benefit, and there is... It's awesome that DMing is a bit hard. That is part of the allure of all this. And they need to be careful not to undo that, because that is actually where a lot of the money and allure comes from.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of money and allure, Critical Role has launched their Daggerheart playtest. This is the second RPG released by Critical Role's Darrington Press. And now you can get the rules and playtest as well. The packet says that it is a rules light game, but it's fairly tactical with some pretty complex interactions. The playtest document itself cites influences ranging from 13th Age to Blades in the Dark to D&D to many others. We have a link in the show notes to that document. You can also find a video in our show notes where Spencer Stark and Matt Mercer review the game. There's coverage all over the internet of this, people weighing in with their thoughts. Friend of the show Tom Christie and DM David reviewed the playtest packet, and Teos is going to be joining them for a game next week to play.
Yeah, this week now.
Lucky. Yeah, that's right, this week. And Demiplane, where you can create characters for different games, including 5e D&D, also has a Dragonheart Nexus, so you can make a character, find a group, and start play testing. What'd you think of the tail? What did you think of the interface?
Amazing. I mean, I can't believe they made that in like no time at all. The Daggerheart interface on Demiplane is gorgeous, really cool looking. It's great, you know, and there are some fun things, and you can make a fraud character and all those kinds of stuff. The game itself, it's funny because that, like we said, they say, you know, like, oh, rules light, but it involves a lot, right? You're rolling two dice, and if one die is bigger than the other, then that's hope or it's fear, and maybe the DM got some points in fear because you rolled fear, or maybe this happened. And then there are abilities that sort of feel like fourth edition or 13th age in many ways. And they come as cards, which is kind of cool with these highly visual aspects. There's some really interesting aspects to it, and some like things we were talking about, hit points. There are ways that you can sort of choose to keep yourself alive, but then there are times by reducing damage coming in. And then there are things like when you actually are going to die, you get one of three choices for how to resolve that, including like going out with a last attack that's a critical hit or a skill check that's a critical hit, or you can like risk it and see whether you heal or die. Some really interesting takes on this that are very Critical Role and sort of style. So it'll be interesting to see how people like it when they start playing it, and how sticky this ends up being. But yeah, I'm looking forward to playing this with Tom and gang, and see how that
Yeah.
feels.
I was invited, but I'm going to be at Gary Con, so I couldn't make it. But I wish I was there rolling those two D12 with you. And now you could play Daggerheart in space if you buy Dwarven Forge new Starforge set. It's terrain taken to the stars. It's all about space bases. Terrain can be flipped upside down to create buildings for outside scenes or for wargaming. What do you think of this product that they're putting out?
It's amazing, and thank you to Nate and the team. I was watching one of their live streams about this product, and they mentioned our show, which is really kind. So it's only fair that we mention their terrain in return, because we do love what they create so much. And I was just sorting my Dwarven Forge last night. This set looks gorgeous. It's beautiful. They are clearly doing a really nice job of trying to cater to both war gamers and RPG players. It makes me want to run Expedition to the Barrier Peaks all over again. Really cool rooms, really neat looking, like, you know, computer terminals and sleep chambers and you know, display screens and stuff like that. And then just neat looking metal walls and pipes and things like that that you can use. And it's all compatible. So they have examples of like, you know, a metal kind of fortress surrounded by woods and mountains and things like that. So it looks great. The team just makes incredible terrain. I love it. And the only problem is, you know, you've got to be able to afford it, which is the downside. It's
Or you could
beautiful.
use it for your Aspergenesis game.
Yes. In fact, I mentioned that on their stream because I'm like, this is perfect. Running the I think I will. I think I will run the Aspergenesis version of Barrier Peaks and see how that goes, and maybe I'll
There
get
you
some of
go.
this terrain. So.
Nice. And now our creator and crowdfunding corner, starting with Surviving Strange Hollow. The Kickstarter continues. Thank you to everyone who supported it so far. We're approaching 80,000. And again, I hope, you know, if you enjoy, I've talked about it enough. I don't need to reiterate what it is. If you enjoy that sort of game, we'll want new rules to cover some things that maybe 5e doesn't cover very well. You can go to that Kickstarter, which ends April 4th at 11 a.m. Eastern. And we also have a new Kickstarter out for the Zweihänder RPG, the Reforge Edition. We talked about it on the show before. It's been doing very well. A great game and a great campaign setting. Daniel Fox and that team, we wish you great success. That campaign ends on April 7th with a link in our show notes. And now on to our main topic this week, designing an RPG starting village. We switched from Shadow Dark to world building for a couple of
Mm-hmm.
episodes, and we really got a big boost in feedback about, oh, this is what I come to your show for. Let's get some more of this. So we're going to dig a little bit into that. For this reason also, in the last few weeks, I've had to create for a couple of different projects two new starting villages from the ground up, and also did some outlining for other ones. And then I had to think about them as starting points for adventures or for campaigns. So I hearkened back to that world building that the conversation we've been having. So I really wanted to talk about it some more. So let's dig into world building via a starting village for your adventures or for your campaign. Did you have anything to say just in general about this topic?
Yeah, I mean, I love it because I've often been impressed by products that will do one of two things. Give you an enormous amount of lore that you can't use. So here's everything about this town. Oh, hey, the adventure happens in the tavern and at the docks, and the rest of it was useless. Or it sets up a really interesting and sort of enchanting place. And then you never come back to it for the adventure anyway. So why did we work that hard when we're leaving it all behind? And those aspects have always interested. I can't help but think of village building and think about those two issues that always kind of get under my skin.
And the history of D&D has a history of these villages. They seem to go hand in hand with D&D. One of the first adventures I remember playing was Village of Hamlet, obviously, which was meant to be the lead-in to Temple of Elemental Evil, although it took close to 10 years, I think, or maybe even more, or maybe just sh maybe 8, for that big Temple of Elemental Evil adventure to come out. So people would, oh, I have to start a new campaign. I'm going to plop down Hamlet and we're going to use this again. And that sort of introduced villages as starting points, villages as hubs for adventurers. And we learned what that sort of design looked like to do well, or what it looked like when it maybe wasn't done so well, and what else was needed.
Yeah, if I could say Hamlet is interesting because it's from this kind of older school of thought of sort of being very encyclopedic, right? Every house detailed, how many copper pieces are hidden, in the false post of the bed and things like that, and what the, farmer in this place is into in the name of all their kids and stuff like that. And on one hand, that was amazing because when you started to know, like if you used Hamlet several times, well, boy, you started to really know that village and you could really breathe some life into it. And the fact that the adventure and the system itself required you to go back and rest all the time meant constant interactions there. And so that was very useful. But as you started going into the future of D&D and the way the gameplay changed and the characters changed, it was a lot, right? And if you looked at it through fresh eyes, you realized, man, trying to read all, you can't separate what's important and what's not. And also the adventure itself can be very boring. If someone walks in on the intended road and the first five buildings have nothing to do with anything, and yeah, they can be fun interactions, but they can also be pretty lame. And so then you start revisiting what, how should we do this, right?
And it introduced DMs to that dilemma of, all right, my player is going to investigate everything, so I need to put something cool in everything, even though these first five buildings are just farmhouses. Okay, so now I need to do something cool. Okay, this farmer is actually a werewolf. Da, da, da. Okay. And oh, you go to the next one. All right, I need to do cool something here. And before you know it, you've overextended yourself, and now you've got 27 different plots going on. And you haven't even gotten to the plot that you had planned on doing.
And
So
we
it
see
was sort of
this
instructive.
even in the starter set, right? Like I like the design of Phandolin in the starter set, but if you look at sort of how it plays out for a new DM, all the plots are there all at once, running into your DM brain, especially if you're a new DM. And it's really overwhelming how many things there are happening all at once when there's some obvious, here's we're really where we want to go. But the campaign, the book isn't necessarily leading you there, right? Because it just vomits forth all the info.
So going on this idea that there are different kinds of world building, especially from bottom up or top down, starting with a village where the characters will start their campaign or their adventure is one of the most bottom up world building techniques you can have. So you're starting with what your characters will be touching first, which is a location. Probably within this village, either walking into town or already starting in the town. So we'll say that your characters are going to start in a town, but you want to put them in a building. So we're going to say a temple rather than a tavern. All right. The priest or the priestess or the acolyte is going to be the one to give them the adventure. So I'm going to start in a temple. How do you start? What do you start with? There are different ways you can do this. The first thing you might want to do is think, what will my players ask? What will they ask about? Will they ask what the structure looks like? Possibly. So you may want to make a note about that. What about the interior? Okay. Without going into too many details, you'll just get an idea of what the interior is. How will that be decided? It might be decided by what god, goddess, or pantheon the temple is set up to. So now we've already gone from top from bottom up to okay, gods. I need to think of gods. So what sort of thing? You don't have to answer all those questions right now. You don't need to denote
Right.
what every god is, but you can just say, all right, this is since it's at in a port, this is going to be a sea god. Or since it's in a field, it's or in a plains area, it's going to be a nature farming god. All right, now I will move on. So you've already started working your way up or working your way out by asking what god. So now you ask yourself, are there going to be encounters taking place here? And if so, what do I need for those? Or is it just going to be the plot hook is delivered? So what do I need to know for that? And so you start with just those, that location and those questions. But those questions that you answer will spur different elements that you're going to create. So start thinking immediately about what the utility of the place is, as opposed to just trying to build it because it's there.
And I'll say that in this process, which I really like that you're describing, one of the keys is kind of having the theme in mind or starting to develop the theme that you're going to have for this location, which I know you're going to talk about next. But as we're working on this temple, right, we might want, it's not like we just roll a D100 and decide what the god is. That's a purposeful decision because it's going to color things, right? If we're on a coastal town, the god shouldn't be the god of the mountains unless the mountains so loom over this coastal town that they're actually bigger than, an Umberlee type, ocean god or weather god, right? But it's probably going to be more like that unless there's some other reason. Like this is such a mercantile place that then it's going to be a god of finance or, or whatever it might be. Or this was such a hard fought place that it's a god of war because it was the conquest of this from other peoples that led to, whatever it is, but that tells your story and starts putting in those themes, because the reality in all play is you have surprisingly small amount space of time and words and all of that to paint your picture. So everything should be part of that painting, right? Or most things should be.
And then you would, when you get a at least a base for this temple, you need to ask, okay, where do they go next? Is the next step that they're going to go to the inn to get rooms, or is it they're going to go to the sheriff's to find information? So you sort of move along the plot that you are at least planning to make the next location. And each time you create a location, you're adding more depth to the village, the town, the city as a whole. And then at some point, you need to answer the question for yourself, what is the purpose of this village? Because what the purpose of the village within your story, whatever that is, will inform its design. So, for example, is this village going to be used as a base where the characters constantly return to? Is it their safe space where they go out on adventures, but once they come here, you could sort of take your armor off and not worry and spend a week without having to roll random encounters? Is that the purpose? Is this a place where the adventures start from? So even though adventures might take place in another location, the adventure actually starts in the village because the catalysts of this story, right? The two temples are the god of war and the god of something, and they're at each other's throats
Right.
constantly. So that's going to be the impetus for it. So that will mean you have to create this village in a different way. Are you going to be running adventures and encounters within the village itself? Like Orlane in against the Call
Altador.
of the Reptile God. That was meant for encounters to be run there, so it needs to be designed slightly differently. You have to answer those questions as you are building these locations and other parts of the village to get it to work exactly as you need it to.
Yeah, and the idea of a village as a base is really great. It takes a little more work in these editions. We see that in Shadowdark, right? Where it was like, how long are you going to press your luck exploring? Because eventually you're going to run out of light and you're going to run out of health and you need to get back and you need to sell your loot and convert it. And so you're going to get your XP and your coins and all of that and do downtime only by getting back to civilization, right? But we can still play off of that as well. And we you and I reviewed the what's it called? Keep on the Shadowfell. And in that, there's some nice design around the what's it called? It's called a Winterhaven, the town in there, where not only are there interesting NPCs, but the NPCs sort of have new things to say when you come back having discovered other stuff, which keeps it alive, right? And that's one of the things you can look at too when you're designing a village is if I'm going to come back to this, are there new things that can, can it play out over time? Because I don't necessarily need to cover it all initially. So maybe we go to the temple, but we go to the guilds after the first adventure or whatever, right? And then we get to tell new aspects of the story of this place relevant to the plot, because we're thinking that way and that lets us design differently.
You don't want your village to be more interesting than the adventures that the characters are going to go on. And that sort of gets to that Village of Hamelin example of trying to add cool things as players investigate. And pretty soon they don't care about, the Earth cult or the moat house because look at all the cool stuff happening here. So that's one thing. But you do want it to be interesting enough that players will still want to explore it in time to learn what it can offer them, both in terms of the mechanics, magic weapons, potions, selling
Storm
things.
King, it's interesting in that it has those three starting locations. And there are some details in those that it's like, when is this coming up? What am I hanging around here? And like, am I fighting some of these townsfolk? Or like, why do I need to know these various bits? It doesn't serve the purpose of what the story is doing. And boy, by the way, we're going to leave it and never come back to it and care about it again. So.
And if it is going to be a hub, this village, it's going to be a base or the safe space. You do want to leave room to show changes and consequences of the characters' successes, failures, inaction, choices, and so on. Because otherwise, it's just a static thing. And it's a tool that you can use storytelling wise to show some of the things that you otherwise wouldn't be able to show. This the general store is basically bare. Why? Because the bandits that you didn't go investigate and instead went to the Lost Temple now got the last three caravans coming through that had goods. You can't buy any more rations, or you can't buy any more blank because of that. That breathes life into your story.
Those ways of nailing down the character of the place are really important, right? Where if you if you don't know, think of your of like a checklist of things the character should be able to answer after having spent some time there, right? How does this building survive? Why is it situated here? Who's in charge of it? What are the main power brokers? Those don't have to be the point of it of things, but if your town is going to feel cohesive, the village should have those things represented, right? Like over time, you should get it. Like I think one that's done really well in fifth edition, in what is otherwise an up and down adventure, is in Princes of the Apocalypse. Red Larch has a lot of like, these people make wagons. These people mine stone that is sold off to this other city, and it tells you which one. And so you get it. You get that there are farmers, and there's this m mining taking place of marble, and there's the Wainwright. And then they also color it with there are a couple of factions going on, right? Both the sort of fifth edition factions, but also some sort of cultist evil stuff. And that layers things where in almost any location is in a camp of neutral with the village or in with part of this cult or part of this other thing, right? And so that then allows you to tell the story better over time with that.
And that's where you get into the second one question I had there, or the second point, which was a place to introduce adventures from. That's where you need the instigators to be a part of the village so that the players aren't going to know this, but they're going to figure it out over time. They may, especially if they're veteran players, they're not like, okay, we're going back to town. The town is totally safe, and that's going to be what this is. But then things start happening, and now the town turns into the generator of the adventure rather than just a safe space. And that's when you do things like factions. That's when the plots of the dungeon interweave with the plots of civilization. Undermountain is great. Undermountain is much greater when Waterdeep is tied to it, right? When something happening in Undermountain could affect Waterdeep. When the politics of Waterdeep send something into Undermountain that you then have to go find. All of that begins working together to deepen the story because of the village or the city in this case that you've chosen to work within your campaign.
Yeah, I love that.
And the final one, a place to run adventures in. If the starting point is also going to be the adventure site, you need to think about those sites as well. Certain locations will probably not become important until down the road. So you need to make sure you know enough about them to present them in a way that the players, when they get to that location 5 levels from now, when they realize that the owner of the tavern is really a vampire spawn who's keeping its master in its basement. You need to have given just enough information so the players go, oh, that's why it was always closed during the day, but only opened after 5 p.m. Or, oh, I remember that that one NPC disappeared and he was last seen there. That's why. Okay. It can't be too obvious because then they'll try to investigate it right away. But you need to give just enough of that tease that it's an aha moment and an of course moment at the same time.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and depending on the size of your village and what's going on, the whole faction piece is a nice way to tell a story too, right? Because it allows you to color the town in certain ways that kind of does more lifting for you, right? If you are saying that the vampire is part of a certain guild and they control it, or a faction, right? It's the leadership of the town, or it's the old council that gathers on weekends to, you know, influence how the village should be run, then that can explain a lot, right? Or if it's part of the merchants that always do this particular, you know, they're responsible for the money in the place, then you can kind of paint with that brush, and all of the things can go towards supporting each other. All of the things that are happening with that merchant side can then support the story that you're weaving.
Yep. So the final question I'm going to bring up is actually multiple questions, which is, what are some things that you definitely need when you create this starting village for your adventure or for your campaign? And the answer is some you probably need, some you probably don't need, but it all depends on what you're using that village, that adventure impetus for. So do you need in a starting village, a reason for the characters to be there? Sometimes. If you tie a character's goals to the town, that can often be a good hook. You are going here because blank, because you've heard rumors about something, because you need information to achieve a further goal, right? A goal to go there is handy, but it's not necessary. They could just be traveling along that road because that's where they were traveling at the time.
Yeah.
But then you quickly need to get to a reason for them to be there.
Yeah. And that's where I think that you can approach it either of those ways, right? You can have a wide variety of why they're here, but why should the characters care and why should they interact? That's going to need to be there, right? So like we did in the ACK Inc. book, there was one of the parts where we wrote that you go to Luskan, and you know, Luskan's big. It's not a village. Mm-hmm. It's a big city. And so
right,
they could get really lost. So one of the things that we did is the scene literally has someone getting thrown out of a tavern, a violin flying through the air or whatever it is, some musical instruments that you can choose to grab. And this person that clearly has a problem and needs help. So it's just the adventure finds you and gets right. you involved. And through this person, you can learn about the things that are in your quest. You can get leads that takes you to somewhere else, where you can then, you know, really follow sort of the steps in your adventure. That helps you get past the why am I here? What am I doing? What's the point? There's an adventure that I've worked on where everybody's coming to this town with a minor quest. And it's just a small minor thing. Sometimes they're kind of funny, but what it does is it requires you to talk to a village in this small, or to an NPC in this small village. And so you get to know the village and the character of it, and you now have reason to understand everybody and you care about it because you have had to talk and interact with them. Now these people matter to you. They're important. You understand the character of the village. Now you're in a great position to save it.
Yeah, exactly. And even if you are the DM who says, I don't want to railroad my players' characters, I don't want to tell them what to do, I want them to just do whatever they want, a village is still good, because even though you're letting them do whatever they want, even if there's 20 businesses or 20 buildings, that's at least narrowing it down to 20 things. Right.
And railroading is really when they say, oh man, there's a circus in town, let's go there. And you say, no, you need to go to the docks.
Right.
Right. That's a railroad, because you know, all the other stuff's useless. You must go here. Useful and not railroading, you know, can feel very good is, boy, we're looking for clues about which pirate's involved. Hey, this random person you bump into has some window into that and can provide clues for you and send you to the right place. That's not a railroad. That is what you want. That's what you're looking for.
Right.
And if you want to use other means to get there, you can as well. But boy, look, you've got some answers already. And it frees you up to be creative around what you do with the information, right? You can also be linear and boring, right? If you run into somebody and they tell you everything you need to know, and then you just listen to them and then go to that place, well, that's boring. It's not just, it's not about the railroad part of it. It's about the fact that there's nothing for you to do here, right? Sometimes you see that in adventures where it's you meet the NPC and you listen to them and you've got nothing to do but go to that next place. Well, that's boring.
Or you don't know where to go, so you go to the next place, and that's also boring. And then you go to the next place, and you're searching, your players are searching for the adventure and are being kept from it by a predetermined vision of what this world is.
Yeah, so with the, in the village context, hopefully what's happening here is that you are getting an understanding of what this place is. You've got a, you either had a reason to be there and that's progressing, or now that you've gotten here, because it was just supposed to be a place to stay for the night, something has happened that interests you, right? And you care about it, are interested in it, and want to see how it goes, so you're taken off from there and meanwhile learning about the character of the place.
So a reason to be there, yes, at some point. Doesn't have to be immediately, but should be coming to them pretty quickly. NPCs to interact with. Always, I'm going to say pretty much always. Not just to get them into the story, but to give you a voice to talk to the characters through in an in-character manner. So you need those ends, you need those ways.
And role playing is such a big part of a game that you want interesting characters, right? Like quirky people that can reflect or contrast with the nature of the town. Like one of the 5e towns that I really like is what Scott creates, Scott Fitzgerald Gray in the Hidden Halls of Hazzacor. He has a town that you're meant to come back to, and it has some interesting people. So things like the person you're going to sell your treasure to, there is an interesting piece there. And so it'll play out over time and have something for the players to interact with and think about and all, right? So you can think through that, like, oh yeah, definitely I want NPCs. How do I make them interesting? Well, are they aligned with, against your goals? Do they have a quirk that you're gonna have fun with? Do they have something that you need to solve for them, right? Like, and they may not even ask for the help, but you sense they need that help, right? Those kinds of things create really great, interesting play.
And think ahead to what the characters may want to do down the road in their adventuring career and the plot that they're following in the story that you're telling with them. Because you want to introduce those NPCs a little bit ahead of time. Just so when it does come up that they're needed, the players will say, "Hey, isn't there a jeweler in town that you've mentioned? All right, yes, let's go to the jeweler to study this gem that we found in the eye of the idol because it's magical and they might know." So, yeah. Next is locations. Do you need those? Yeah, generally, yeah. You don't need to make too many, but you need to put in the ones that are either useful immediately or will be useful down the line. Adding more than you need does give depth to the world. It does give depth to the stories. But getting too deep in world building sometimes drowns the players. So you have to take into account what sort of verisimilitude that the players want. Do they want to go, to a different butcher, baker, or is just like one foodstuffs person enough to get everything done?
Well, and one thing you want to not do is like ignore the thing that will likely come up, right? So in a small village, if someone's looking for rumors or information, heading to the tavern or inn makes sense. And if you don't detail that, well, then now your DM's got to just improvise on the fly. And it doesn't take a lot. Like, you could just detail the person who maintains the tavern or who's on duty there, and one interesting customer, and a few lines about the general character, and now they've got all they need to go. It reminds me of often in big city adventures in Living Greyhawk, organized play campaign, folks would start to play other adventures where you do things like go to the Library of Greyhawk for information. So anytime they were in Greyhawk, if they ran into a lore problem, they'd be like, can we go to the library? And a lot of times the adventurer hadn't thought of that. And it's like, well, by now, in this point in the campaign, players know that there is a giant library with all kinds of lore. They're going to want to go there. You know, like, oh, it's closed today? Like, what do you. So
Yeah.
it was fun to see sometimes DMs go, like, I don't know what to do right now. And
Right.
the same thing can happen in a village, right? Where if you want to deal with certain types of issues, and that's probably where you want to think through, what are my plots? And is there naturally some sort of place that they're just going to go to, right?
That's exactly right. Then we get to the theme. Does a village need a theme? And the answer is no, but it doesn't hurt. It can be very useful to you as a storyteller and to the players as agents of that story to have a theme in mind so that you can continue to stress something that a player might be trying to gravitate toward or to hold on to. So we already used the example of a port sit village versus one that's a farming community in the plains versus one in the mountains. That's a sort of theme that you can use, the location. You can also use a theme that's a little more esoteric, like gloomy
It's falling apart.
or falling apart, right? Or festive. Everyone in town parties, and it's always Oktoberfest in this town. And that's okay too, right? Artsy, or very agrarian. Not that those two have to be mutually exclusive, but give it
Yeah,
a
is it on the
theme,
rise? Is it in decline,
right?
right? Like those things can all be really useful. And one interesting thing to look at is like if you look at the 10 towns of Icewind Dale and they try to characterize, some of the towns really just sink into like obscurity of your brain, and others, you know, oh yeah, this is the one that makes all the beer. So I remember that one, and this is the one with the big keep, and this is, you know, like, so what makes your place stand out and amongst other villages, especially if they're going to visit other places, you know, how does this stick in their mind for the players and give them something that is useful?
And the last one I'll ask, even though there's many more, I'm sure, is does the town need a history? And the answer is not really, unless the history is important to the current action or to what the characters will be interacting with down the line. Forever, Village of Hamlet talks about the Battle of Emredy Meadow or something. And I was just like, as I'm reading, I'm like, okay, this doesn't really help me run this adventure. Sure, this happened back then, and it was the rise of the temple the first time, but it doesn't really, you could play the adventure never knowing that history. And it sort of felt a little indulgent.
Oh,
It's
yeah.
like, whoa, we played this as our players, so we are going to add this now to show. And I guess it's cool if you're one of the players in that
Sure.
game,
Yeah.
but it doesn't really add anything to the story going forward. As a DM, you can certainly think it's cool and you can tie it to it, but it doesn't go back and, except for the video game where you can go to the battlefield
I love that. Yeah. That
and
was great.
dig up some things. That was cool. Now, if that had happened during the actual Village of Hamlet adventure, that would have been, something else, but it didn't.
And I think that's where you want to look at what the point of your village is periodically and reassess is what I'm building on point, right? If this is a stop along the way where some questions are answered, then focus on that, right? Don't get lost in the Battle of Emredy Meadows or any of these other things because that's just too much and we're going to leave anyway. Don't create, you know, a giant plot for the players to explore, right? Like you don't need a conflict between the town council and the merchants if the players aren't meant to solve it or really even interact with it. You know, beware doing that, and then suddenly that becomes the adventure and you're intending for them to move on and go somewhere else, and then they want to fix the town council, right? Run for mayor, any of that, right? If you're going to do that, then you want that to be a possibility that they could actually win or any of that, yeah.
And if you're creating something for your own home campaign, obviously do what you like, right? But when we talk about the things that you don't need, It's because you might like them, but not everyone will. And you always risk by putting in things that you think are cool, but that aren't necessarily important, you run the risk of losing the DM or losing or help
Players.
forcing the players to the DM to lose the players as the DM tries to make this important when it's really not. So just keep that in mind as you say, but I love the Emery Meadows thing. That was the coolest thing. For you, yes, and that's great. Not for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing about Hamlet is I think I love so many different things that are in that town because I've played it and ran it so many times that it made sense to me. But it was hours of play that were unfocused and yeah, if it had been pared down to reflect the scenes or for example with Lost Mines of Phandelver, if the town's quests kind of came in waves, it would be a lot easier to run. And then it would allow you to have those waves tell a better story, right? Why are we just going out to this random place to do this quest? Well, because it links in the following way, right? Or because winning this NPC over leads to the town, accepting you as heroes and then asking this of you, right? We start telling better stories when we can channel that experience, and the village is a powerful means by which we get to do that, right?
There you go. So, that is our look at the starting villages. We've also looked at the starting scenes of many different adventures. And you can go back in our catalog to look at some of those where we would have discussed these areas as starting locations for adventure. Teos, thank you for sharing your expertise
And you.
and. And thank you to all of our listeners. We appreciate you taking the time each week to listen to us talk about our favorite hobby. If you are a supporter of our Patreon, we thank you as well. If you're a Master of Dungeons supporter, you are what we are here for. So thank you. Our Master of Realms supporters get a shout out in our show notes. And our Master of the Multiverse patrons, well, you get a shout out right now. Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing. Lou Anders of Crazy Lazy Wolf Studios. Craig Bailey, Steve Bissonette, Merrick Blackman, Evil John, Darren Chandler, Seth Eckel, Andy Edmonds at Nerdronomicon.com, Nathan Fuller, The Mighty Jerd, Ben Heisler and Paige Lightman, Sean Hurst, Chad Jackson, Brian King, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Chad Lench, the Mathemagician, Eric Menge, the Micro Ant, Sean Molly, Falcon Neil, Tom Nelson of the Deck of Player Safety, Mike Olson, Mighty Zeus, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Robert Pasley, Vladimir Prenner from Croatia, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, Ross Sandberg, Andy Shockney, Krishna Samose, Trace, Joe Tyler, James Walton, Graham Ward, Xavier Wozniak, and Chris Webster. Thank you so much for your support. If you like our content and you want to help us out, you can go to patreon.com/masteringDnD. Even if you can't support us in that way, it would be super helpful if you would go to the places where you listen and leave us a review because that helps other people understand that sometimes we do good stuff here. And you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/@masteringdungeons. So, Teos, where can people find your great work?
Ooh, well, find me at alphastream.org. You can read that article I talked about last week on Emerald City Comic Con. And one of the fun things people have been enjoying is looking at the character sheets that we used. And that's been fun for folks to look at. Where
You
do we find
go.
you, Sean?
You can find me on Twitter at Sean Merwin, and you can follow the podcast at Mastering D&D on all of the social media sites like Twitter and Mastodon and Blue Sky. You can join our community and ask us questions and talk to us via Patreon. We have a Discord where our Patreon supporters can congregate and often have great discussions. And you can leave comments on our YouTube channel, Mastering Dungeons. Whew. So we've entered the village. We are looking for adventure. What are we going to do now?
Well, I'm gonna look for a drunk called Otis.
I'm going to go to the third barn on the left and go to the hay mound and dig up the plus one dagger and 250 gold pieces. Because I have a feeling it's there.
That's good town design.